Chris Griswold.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, buddy. It's good to talk to you. This is episode 232 of Highway Diary with a friend of mine, Chris Griswold. I haven't talked to in about 10 years.
That's right. How's it going?
Good, man. How are you? So I'm doing stand-up in New Jersey. You're teaching. We first met via kind of the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York City. I want to say that was like 2006, 7, 8 type of time frame.
Well, we met in improv class, right?
Yeah, was that like a Billy Merritt class?
That was 2004.
Okay.
And that was Improv 101. Did you have Jackie Clark as a teacher?
I did. Oh, okay. So that's the... Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it was Improv 101, and I... back at that time, there weren't a lot of ways to meet other people at UCB very easily. And so what I would do was I would miss two classes on purpose so that I could sub into other classes.
Okay. So you subbed into our class one time?
And then you guys asked me to be in your class show, and I actually became friendlier with people in that class than the one that I was actually supposed to be in.
It's weird, because maybe the other one that you were supposed to be in, they were already friends, you know, and they kind of locked you out of a clique, you know?
That's it. I showed up, and I alienated everyone immediately. That's usually my plan.
How'd you do that?
What's that? How did I do that?
Yeah, how'd you accomplish alienating yourself immediately?
Oh, you know, I just usually just spray cat urine on people, and that'll take care of it.
You marked your territory.
Yeah, that's right.
That was more that was like a dominance type of maneuver.
Well, alpha moves, baby. That's right.
So now you're in San Francisco. You went to the UCB to gather your spirit knowledge there. When'd you move to San Fran or Oakland?
When did I? May. I started teaching in Palo Alto. I taught some beginner classes over the course of the summer, and now I'm in Oakland. I'm teaching in San Francisco. In New York City, my niche was, improv should be for everyone. Hey, everyone should be, this should be opening people up instead of closing people down. Here, it feels like that's already taken care of, and so my focus tends to be on grad school for improvisers, essentially. You know, you've learned these skills, what do you want to do with them now? And so I do classes where we create shows. So, yeah.
That's awesome. What I'm doing. And you're like kind of like the shaman for independent groups, is that what I'm hearing?
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, I do that, and then I run my own classes also. Yeah, so I do both. And then I do some corporate work here and there.
Great. Well, I always remembered you. You're very, very funny, very talented off the bat. I remember when you were at that level one of UCB, you already kind of seemed to have a lot of training behind you, right?
I taught myself from books about 20 years ago. I was in Pittsburgh. I started off in Pittsburgh. And I was going to an improv show called Friday Night Improvs. It's one of the longest running improv shows in history. That's right. And I would go to this show, and it was a short form improv jam. So it was like, whose line is it anyway? But there were no set performers. The performers were all pulled from the audience. So for a long time, I was very spoiled by having an audience of 150 or more people watching me figure out improv for, you know, week after week. And after about a year doing that, I asked, you know, what do I do to get better? People offered me or, you know, suggested some books to me. So I read Impro by Keith Johnstone and Truth in Comedy by Kim Johnson. They were great. And so I kind of read things in the books, and then I coached myself through improv using those on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was me and you and someone codenamed Heather were in a practice group for a while, and we kind of did little odd shows here and there back in New York.
That's right. This was the first time I ever ate Chipotle, and we would practice in an NYU dorm.
That's right. And Zach Woods was our practice coach for a couple times, right?
Was he? I just remember the The person you're talking about, yeah, absolutely, yes. Because, yes, he was an NYU person. Did we have Zach Wood? I don't know. I feel like I haven't had Zach Woods as a coach. That's
I know Heather and I did for a couple times. I'm not sure if you were a part of that or not. You know,
I think that I was also just very depressed, and I moved back to Pittsburgh.
So when I met you, you were you had a fiance, but you were kind of lonely because you came alone and you were living in Queens. And I remember hanging out at your apartment one time, and you know, you were like, ah, fuck, you know. I think we had some beers. We just talked about ladies, you know, basically. And good times, but you know. We kind of lost touch for a while, and then all of a sudden I'm following this series called Moth, and I see you do a Moth story slam, and that's the first time I got wind that you and your marriage fell apart. And I'm going to play a clip right here, if you don't mind.
What a weird way to talk about that.
So, but also, that's the theme. I worked with this amazing person, named Daisy, and we were not going to be working together much longer, so we started hanging out, and we were going to wingman for each other. We were going to just introduce each other to other people in the bar. We'd both gotten out of these long-term relationships that had just fallen apart, as they frequently do, and we just went to a bar, and we were going to introduce each other to other people, and we just kept talking. And then it just kept happening and happening, and we kept saying we can't do this. Both of us were terrified of doing anything.
So yeah, that's when I was like, wow, what's going on with Chris? He got a. Were you married to that person?
No.
From Pittsburgh?
No,
not Daisy, I mean, the person before.
What?
I remember you had a fiance. Did you, were you, was that your fiance back in 2007, your fiance for a long time, or did you guys get married?
No, I moved back to Pittsburgh. We had gotten engaged when I was in New York, because the plan was she was going to follow me to New York. And then I was feeling depressed, and I'd been diagnosed as having dysthymia. It's one of a number of fun diagnoses that I've gotten. But I wasn't really sure what to do. And, you know, I had all these great friends in Pittsburgh, and I retreated. I went back to Pittsburgh. I wasn't really ready for what I was doing. So I go back, and then as soon as I get back there, she tells me, this is a woman I was engaged to, she tells me, oh, by the way, we're not going to be here for 1 year as we had agreed. She was still in college. I'd just been out of college. And she said, I'm adding a fifth year to my undergrad work. And then I want to, because I want to be a veterinarian suddenly. She had been a philosophy student for 4 years and then just decided to become a veterinarian and was doubling up on organic chemistry and all these... and all these classes, and it was just the worst year. I felt like I had been misled. And then also, if you're engaged to someone, you don't just suddenly make a huge life decision without going like, hey, what do you think about this?
Right.
Because you're engaged.
It's your team.
So,
I'm sorry, Chris, what's dysthymia? I've never heard of that one.
It's depression. It's a chronic depression.
Okay.
It basically means I was born depressed, baby. So I was back in Pittsburgh, and I was dealing with that, and you know, going and like actively, you know, going to therapy and seeing a psychiatrist and treating my depression. Also, I was not diagnosed at that time as being bipolar, and so the antidepressant they put me on, which is called Wellbutrin, they gave to me, and it made me crazy. So I was, that's not something you really give to someone who's bipolar because it makes them very manic. So I'm going through this. She's going through a year of just like too much science and just going through the worst year of her life. And then our roommate, who was her best friend, one of my close friends, her mother died suddenly, and then a couple months later, her father just fell down and died. It was just like sudden death. So she was going through the worst year of her life, and it was three people just trapped in hell with each other. So that went really well.
Yeah, you're manic. Your fiance's on too much science. You know, your roommate's grieving.
And she was taking it out on me. It was like she was, yeah. It was really, it was tough. She got kind of abusive in the house. So I was dealing with that too because I was trying to be a friend to her, but she wasn't particularly emotionally developed at that point and was going through one of the toughest things she'd ever gone through.
Well, it's kind of hard to you need space and relaxation to develop. I mean, if it's just science and exams, I mean, you're kind of in a trance just doing the task you have to do every day, you know?
Completely. So, yeah, what a mess. But, yeah, that ended. I moved. Well, then I went to grad school. I went to Ohio University for journalism. And then I moved to New York City. When there were no jobs, 2009, there were no jobs in journalism or advertising at that time. I had a professor set me up with a bunch of interviews, and by the time I actually got to New York City a couple weeks later, those people had all lost their jobs. So that was interesting. So I do some copywriting here and there, but I never have gone full into the advertising industry, which, from people I talk to, it sounds like I made the better choice.
Well, or journalism. There was no journalism opportunities for you.
Right.
Yeah, that's tough, man. So then what? So you just copy wrote and then just kind of doubled back down on improv in New York City?
Yeah, I got back into improv at UCB. I retook a bunch of the classes, and I did a lot. I've taken more classes at UCB than most people, I would think. I got an internship, and then I had a manager that I worked really well with, and so they kept me around for a long time. I just took class after class after class after class, and then I ended up working in the administration of the school. So when things. Yeah, so I work behind the scenes at both the theater and the training center at UCB.
Cool.
So, and then after that, then I was just I was working 7 days a week at that point. I was working there. I was working other jobs, and then I started coaching again. And I started teaching improv in 1998, but I started teaching about 6 years ago in New York City, full time, independently. People said you can't make a living coaching improv, and yeah, I did very well for a long time. I was working with as many as 13 groups a week for a while there, especially during what was called the big second comedy boom. But I moved to San Francisco because what I developed over those 6 years was my own methodology that gets you results that look like what UCB is going for, but with a sort of a more theatrical, more acting focus to it.
Cool,
I felt like in New York City I was a needle in a haystack. I came here so that I could let what I've created grow among a community that is hungry for what I have.
Yeah, yeah. It's like if all the professors... That's kind of how I felt at the UCB, you know... after I moved to LA in 2009, and then it's like I had to start taking the class again, even though I had a little run of a show, I had to start taking the classes again, and then I saw that the people that were kind of getting through had TV credits, and I was like, wait a minute, this is not, you know what I mean, that guy's not good, but he got through because he's got TV credits, so I just been focused on stand-up, that's how I sort of, I just stopped doing that around 2012 or 2011, only start doing stand-up, because then I figure, well, this is the way I can make my own way, you know?
Yeah, I think that's an accurate perspective on what was happening there. I think that UCB's been a place where, like, good performers perform on stage, but it's never really been the training ground for comedy. You know, it's been packaged that way, and it's been mythologized by the students that way. But it's really, you know, the star of the show is the theater, not the school necessarily.
Yeah, but I mean, I did learn a lot there, and I think, you know, the skills that I developed there were something that I had to eventually, like, you got to graduate yourself after a certain time. You got to go, I'm graduated from this, now let me go fucking take over the world my own way, you know?
Yeah.
But cool, it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing. So then in 2014, yeah. You're living in New York, and you did this Moth performance, because you and this girl Daisy started to hit it off, huh? You had this unrequited love where you're like, oh, we'll be each other's wingman.
And no, we weren't interested in each other at all. She was just, we were friendly, and then we just hung out, and then it developed from that. She was the producer of that show, of The Moth.
Wow.
That was her last night producing, and I decided, and I just impromptu gave that story. It wasn't planned, I just got up and told that story. But yeah, that was her last night producing. So she was sitting right there, and we dated for, 4 or 5 years. We're still really good friends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a big podcasting producer now.
Well, and it seems like a conflict of interest if she's the producer and her the person she's dating is all of a sudden talking all about their love. But then recently you've come out as bisexual.
Yeah, a couple years ago. I just decided to be open about it. I'm not, you know, I'm not aggressively bisexual. I don't know what that means, but in college I used to kind of call myself a lazy bisexual because I just wasn't getting around to it. But I feel like when you're bisexual, it's easy to not deal with that. I've really only dated women or had sex with women, but I think it's important for people of all spots on the Kinsey scale to kind of acknowledge that it is a spectrum. There's a lot of varieties of the LGBTQ sphere that are amongst people all the time and they don't even realize it. And so I think it's important for people to see the variety of people that actually identify this way.
So now are you single? Are you just sort of out there and if someone comes along, then that's how it is? Or what's your status?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I just stopped dating someone recently. She was a Stanford student that I met last summer, and I was like, "Yep, this is also another great reason to be in the Bay Area." But we've actually just become really good friends. Very close friends. We're figuring out plans to go to Disneyland. But yeah, we both are seeing other people now. I'm seeing someone right now. Oh, this is the other thing. I've kind of become, I guess, I don't know. I don't claim this as my identity, but I've just always been an open-minded person. So I've certainly become more polyamorous in the past year. I'm seeing someone now that I've just met this past month that I really like, and she is married and has 2 children. And so I'm exploring this more.
You're just, yeah, the polyamorous. See, I'm so, maybe it's my Catholicism, Chris Griswold, but I'm like so monogamous, and I get freaked out. Like, I'm like, oh, you're talking to him now? Like, I can't get myself out of this shit.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know. After college, I also, before the woman that I got engaged to, I was dating a woman, and she said, you know, I have a crush on our friend. I think I have a crush on our female friend. And I said, well, do what you need to do. That has always been my take in relationships. If someone says, I need this thing, I'm not going to be the person that says no to that, because what's the point? And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But putting up a wall in front of them is not going to make things better. And so actually what happened was the three of us ended up all dating each other. So I had essentially 2 girlfriends and they were dating each other also. But it was kind of like 3 duo relationships. But yeah, I don't know. I've never, I mean, I've also, I think, you know, when I went through to grad school, I had a tough time and some terrible things happened. And I went through a kind of a weird patch where I was frequently the other guy, where I was trying, you know, where I, women were doing, were seeing me on the side. And I also, like, I mean, the morality of that, I wasn't too into the being the other guy, but I also wasn't, I never felt jealous.
Did you know they were open? Like, oh, there's, this is my primary partner, but I guess we can see each other or whatever.
No, they were cheating. I had been, I had actually been sexually assaulted in grad school, and so that kind of changed the way that I viewed, I wouldn't say that it just made me question what I felt about love and sex. And so I made choices then that I wouldn't have made before and didn't make, and wouldn't make after that period, where I was just kind of recalibrating. So I was, like I said, women were cheating on their boyfriends with me. Doing, you know, yes, they were having sex with me. I was the sex guy, basically. And again, I that's not a choice that I would be making now, but I also have found polyamory, and I think that a lot of people that have been involved in some part of cheating have found their way to polyamory and realize that's a possibility for them. I certainly don't encourage cheating in any way. But yeah, I mean, I went through that where, but yeah, I mean, I saw someone for a while, and she made it clear that she'd see her boyfriend on the weekend, and she'd see me on she'd see her boyfriend on the weekdays, and I'd see her on the weekend. But she got upset that I wasn't jealous, and I knew what the parameters were.
She's like, isn't that fucked up what I'm doing? Doesn't it drive you crazy?
Right. But that's the thing. I didn't really want to engage with that, and I've certainly I definitely have made much better choices since then. I wouldn't call those things mistakes. I would just call them, just poor choices. And so now with polyamory, I'm able to, I don't know. I mean, the being open sexually is great. Being open romantically, that's sometimes more of a challenge, I feel like. Because you want to be special to someone, and you want someone to be special for you. Those things can still be true, but you just have to kind of deprogram a lot of this monogamy indoctrination that we've had since childhood.
And maybe it's hardwired. I've
certainly done a lot of things in that range of sort of openness.
Were you sexually assaulted by a woman or a man, if you don't mind me asking?
It was a woman. That was a great first guess. It was a woman. That is a possible thing. Mm-hmm. I was in grad school, and then again, I was telling, it was in grad school that I was diagnosed with bipolar. I was on some meds that I mistakenly combined with alcohol, and someone took me to her house in the middle of nowhere, and it happened. The hardest part was when I called the campus, psychology line, whatever, the campus helpline, the therapy line, it kept being rephrased as, so you think you've been raped. It kept being like, you're crazy. It kept being put on me as, this is a claim you're making. Mm-hmm. And that even happened at the campus with the counseling center at Ohio University. They really sort of fumbled that, and that was the part that made it difficult for me, was the refusal to believe me that something terrible had happened.
So were you all, like, drugged out and couldn't, like, move type of scenario? From the alcohol and medication type of...
No. I was not in my right mind, basically. It was like... Honestly, I have related a lot to the character Jessica Jones in Marvel Comics and in the TV show Jessica Jones. And it was weird. I was kind of, I was like easily manipulated that night. I don't know what it was about the combination of drinking and these medications, but I was just, yeah, I just was going along with things and not putting up resistance, even though I wanted to put up resistance. I just found that not a possibility.
Do you think that your improv training broke your brain where it's like, yes, and, okay, this is happening, okay, this is happening, you know what I mean?
No, because, I mean, that's improv training, and I think people yes and too much. To me, I think that, I don't like watching most improv. I'm going to be honest with you, I think most improv is pretty terrible. But it's because most people are learning improv, and I just, it's tough. It's like watching an open mic, like a stand-up open mic, or if you're a guitar player and watching someone play guitar. Like, most improv is pretty terrible, and I think that should be acknowledged, because, but that's true of most art, you know, most poetry is terrible. My frustration with improv frequently is how much people want to yes and constantly, and then call that comedy, but it's really like, okay, we're just watching you be silly for an hour on stage. Who cares? What you need to do is you got to go like, yes, and, but not that. You have to be able to react to when something is unusual, and if that doesn't happen, then I don't know what I'm watching.
Yeah, authentic reactions.
Yeah.
But it could be authentic for a weird character. If a character's weird, what's authentic to that character changes, you know? It's maybe not what a normal person would do.
Well, here's the thing. You're doing stand-up, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you've got a premise and you've got a punchline. You've got, like, a setup and a punchline.
Yeah.
Right. So you go, like, hey, here's a human experience. Great. We checked in with the audience. They go, like, oh, I get that. I've had an experience similar to that, or I understand that experience. And from that, you can go to something surprising. You can talk about a surprising choice you made, or a surprising circumstance, or a surprising metaphor that makes them think about it in a different way. And that's what the joke is always going to be. Any comedic idea is going to be the familiar and the unexpected. But the problem is, people love to go straight for the unexpected over and over and over again. And if they think they found something that makes the audience laugh, they just grind that surprising idea into the ground. And you see it with stand-up, especially at open mics, and you see it in a lot of improv. And, you know, people are trying to have their dessert without eating their dinner.
Yeah, it's all about more setups, more punchlines, more premises.
Yeah, give me something I can identify or recognize, you know, something that can that's familiar to me. If you don't have that, you don't have comedy, you just have, like, a bunch of weird ideas you're saying.
Mm. Now, recently you came out also as gender fluid, as well as bisexual.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, how do you describe your gender fluidity? Does it shift? Do you feel sometimes more feminine? How does this work?
Yeah, I would say that. Sometimes I feel more feminine, sometimes I feel more masculine. It's not something I talk about all the time because I feel like people have difficulty understanding it, but also because to me it's especially a personal thing, and when it comes to things like labeling it, it's very difficult because gender fluid sometimes sounds right, non-binary sometimes sounds right. I generally present as a man, but I also, you know, it's really also hard to separate identity from expression also, because how you feel and the way that you present can be different also, which I don't think people recognize all the time. But I used to hate feminine aspects of myself. There's a certain way that I speak that bothered me for a long time because it sounded feminine to me. But as a child, I always really envied girls. There's a really wonderful aspect of girlhood, certainly from the outside looking in, of just the allowance of you can be emotional and friendly and creative, and that stuff's all seen as normal and okay. But if you're a boy, that stuff seems, it comes across to people as weak, you know, something that's not allowed. Part of the reason I became a feminist was that dawning horror of realizing that everybody in the world didn't love femininity and women and girls as much as I did. And so that really, I've become very outspoken about things that involve inequality for women, because that sort of stuff really bothers me. But yeah, in the past couple of years, I've just been a lot more forgiving, not just forgiving, but like welcoming to parts of myself that made me uncomfortable.
Seems like what you were saying, before, it's like that girl who was like, you know, I also want to date this girl. And you're like, okay, we'll have that. You know, if you want that, you should have that. Then the last person you sort of turned that philosophy to was yourself, where you're like, well, if I want to do this, I should have that, and I shouldn't be a hypocrite for saying one thing and doing another.
Completely. Yeah, I think that I've just I've become open-minded gradually more and more over the course of my life. I mean, certainly, you know, I grew up in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania, in a place that's, it's racist and sexist and homophobic, certainly. It's all of those things. I go to college, and I became an editor of the newspaper, so I joined Black Action Society and the Campus Women's Organization, Rainbow Alliance, just so I could keep in contact with these groups that I knew were not being seen as much as people that looked like me. But even then, I didn't know what I was doing at all, and I made hugely poor choices, even at that time, when it came to those things. But I feel like, especially in the past couple of years, I've made a point to say yes to more things and open my mind, because I think we get trapped in this matrix of what we know and then are not open to things that we don't know. And I mean, again, that's the familiar and the unexpected. Mm. You know, you gotta question what you know and be open to what you don't know.
Mm. Yeah, it just seems. So you always dress masculine, though, right? Do you ever go dress like present feminine?
Not really. I mean, yeah, I don't. I mean, don't be like, okay, I love women's sunglasses. I will dress masculine, and I'll have a beard, but I'll throw on some women's sunglasses. I love that. I just think it's really fun to play with gender like that sometimes.
Do you have a different pronoun for yourself? Do you go with him or Zim,
sir? If other people need that, that's fine. But for me, to me, again, that is like the labels. I really feel like they're for other people and not for me. It's not really a concern for me. Part of it also, I think, is I'm not boxing myself in. And this is extended not just to sexuality and gender, but to belief and to the kind of creativity that I have, the kind of work that I do. You know, I do a lot of things that are not normal for whatever context that I'm doing them in. They're not bad, but like I teach an Improv 420 workshop, which, you know, in I felt like in New York people were like scandalized by or thought it was a gimmick. But that workshop, it's a workshop where people, the students get high and then come and take my workshop. And then in the workshop, I do exercises that are specifically using parts of the brain that the THC is stimulating. And so I'm always trying to do things like this and say, well, what else could we do? What else could this be? I'm certainly not done. I don't know what I'm going to end up like by the end of my life. I'm going to be some really, I don't know. It's going to be unrecognizable, I feel like, to where I started, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to keep exploring and trying to figure out what else is out there.
I just imagine, like, you have a lot of different pocketbooks, and then ferrets and squirrels are in them, and they cross from one pocketbook to another. You know what I mean? I just sense...
So I've got, like, teleportation skills. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you'll have, like, a fanny pack with a skunk in it. You know, you'll just have affectations. You know, you'll just be a man of mystery.
Yeah. I'm definitely gonna be an eccentric if I'm not already.
Yeah, for me, the whole thing, like, when I have a girlfriend, I just feel like, okay, cool, that's good, that's fine, that's my base. I'll see that cutie pants, you know, Friday at 6. Let me go do stand-up. And now that I know that I have this mental anchor in this person with this scheduled date that's going to happen, I can really challenge myself. Like, I can now be fearless on stage in a way that maybe I struggled to have the confidence you know, say the most fucked up thing on stage because, you know, what, I'm just doing it for myself, you know, where I don't, you know, I don't know. I'm more like codependent type of orientated. And I'm trying to...
I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Me too. I want to be clear. Me too. Have you gone... I'll ask you. Have you gone to CODA? Codependence Anonymous.
No, no. I've seen some therapists, though. I went to the University of New Orleans for my master in screenwriting, and there I started seeing a therapist, mm-hmm. and that kind of really helped me.
I'll say this to anyone out there. Definitely check out all of these 12-step programs and self-help groups, because they're amazing. Because I feel like therapy is one thing, and it's really great, especially if you have someone who's not just, like, listening to you, but helps you refocus or reframe things for you and help you develop better habits. I think all of that stuff's really great. I also really think that these groups can be really, really good so that you realize that you're not alone, because I think sometimes you feel like you're weird and then you realize no, this is a human thing. This is familiar to a lot of people. And so I've done Codependence Anonymous before, and that was really good. And I've done, there's ACA. It's the Adult Children of Alcoholics, but your parents don't have to be alcoholics. It's also for people with parents who are narcissists. Yeah. It's like, check, it's basically just teaching you how to, what's that?
Check and check. Go on.
Yeah, it's teaching you how to self-parent. And how to kind of nurture yourself. It's like I find it to be really useful, and it's even just checking. If you check out these organizations' websites, there's always a lot of information on the websites that'll kind of help put you in the right direction.
Yeah, I just read "Emotional Manipulators" by Ross Rosenberg, and that really was whoa, yeah, that's how I was raised. That was I remember that happening, you know.
Well, yeah, part of the reason that I teach comedy is that my father would kind of make fun of me a lot and say horrible jokes to me. One of his favorite jokes was about how they should have left me. He would always just say about they should have left me in the woods in a coffee can, which essentially means as a baby, put me in like a Folgers can and leave me in the woods for the animals or exposure to eat or to destroy. Which is not like a great joke to tell your child. It's one of many, but it's that sort of thing. And part, like I said, part of the reason I'm teaching comedy and have studied how comedy works is to teach people how to make better jokes that aren't going to wound your child and
forever.
Yeah.
What kind of disorder can I create with this horrible phrase? How do I give dysthymia as efficiently as possible?
My dad would joke with us like we were adults and had life experiences equal to his, right. But he didn't understand that he was our father and was just shitting on us. He was just putting us down horribly all the time, even though he thought he was like palling around at lunch with us or something.
Yeah, it's like, don't you realize that you're always the dominant voice. You're always creating the narrative instead of letting me flourish, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like, it was always, like, the way that I ate, you know, but the thing is that he did not realize that he really wasn't intending to be mean. I know that, you know, I've had to understand where he was coming from. You know, I teach, through improv, I teach empathy now. I teach how to connect to loved ones that you can't speak to anymore. I have a company called Engage that does workshops like this that are about connection between people. And I had to turn all these skills that I'd taught other people and all these methods that I'd created, I had to use in my own life. And so one day last summer, I just spent the day thinking about my dad's life and how he got from, you know, how he got from where he started to where he was when he was a parent and why he was doing the things that he did. And none of it was mean-spirited. He was just doing the best he could, and I needed to be able to recognize that. So I couldn't be angry with him, because I think sometimes, especially if it's with a parent, the anger that you have for them is very probably what will make you more like them, because they reacted to the same thing and became that way. Mm. And so you have to kind of break the chain by being empathetic and by letting go and not hating. but instead trying to educate that part of yourself that corresponds to the person that injured you.
Whoa. I find myself just going like, okay, well, let me just do the opposite of that and, like, overcompensate in the other way, like, you know?
Right.
Like, if both my parents were very yelly. Both my parents would flash anger and, like, scream and try to, like, dominate and humiliate in these moments of flash anger. So I never engage in that. That's not a part of my world. That will never be a part of my world. I can't do that. That's not going to happen.
That's great. I mean, yeah, I will definitely. I mean, I relate to the anger also. But, if that's working for you, awesome. I feel like... I think we just have to keep educating ourselves. It's so easy to be frustrated. Because the thing is, parts of them are in you. And those parts either, you know, scare you or make you angry or embarrassed or ashamed. I can't speak to that definitely, obviously. I'm guessing that. But that you have to love those parts of yourself also so that they can heal.
No, I think comedy's been really... instrumental in that, because it's like, you know, if both your parents are narcissists, you just have this feeling like they're not listening. They're not really listening. They're waiting to talk. Yeah. They're waiting to educate. They don't know how to, like, really internalize what I'm saying and then, like, change their behavior the next time we see each other. So for me, it's like comedy, when I can, it's my turn. They hand me the microphone. And then if I get big laughs, those are all fucking mine. And you know what I'm saying? It's like,
right.
No, those are mine. I earned those. It was my turn to talk. And now I can go hide in my bunker now. But, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's hard, too, because parents seem... I feel like parents generally do not understand the world that their children are growing up in. Yeah. Because it's so different from the world they grew up in.
Right.
Like, your parents give you a roadmap to your adult life, but it's from 1948 and no one knows how to fold it. It's so outdated.
And if they're not, I mean, my dad's got a psychology degree in 1971, you know, but I'm the one who's like reads articles about psychology. I saw a psychiatrist for a while, you know what I mean? Like after a certain point, like in 2019, you probably don't have a degree anymore. I probably know more than he does.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you don't read one fucking book since 1978, you don't still have that degree, I feel, you know?
I mean, so totally. I mean, how many things were categorized as mental illnesses that are not at all? And I also want to say mental illness really just means, you know, deviant from societal norm. Doesn't mean that something is wrong with the person. Frequently, it's an issue with society. Like, there's a reason that children in America get diagnosed with ADHD more than in other countries, and it's not because of the children, and it's not a I don't think it's a biological thing. Probably maybe sugar has something to do with it, but we just raise children differently. You know, in other countries, there's a better understanding of child development. And the way that children learn and what their needs are. But the United States, we have taken shortcuts on so many things in life, including food and child education, that we break kids constantly.
Mm. Yeah. And it's like, you know, there's no healthcare here. So everyone, it's like there's that you get into the fight or flight. Man, when I was an exchange student in Germany, I was like, man, these girls are so fucking chill. Like, the Jersey girls are out of their fucking minds, but it's because both the parents are working, both the parents are stressed, you know, the parents come home stressed, they get all yelly, you know, then they send their kid to fucking bed without dinner or whatever, blah, blah, blah. In Germany, they have 6 weeks of vacation. If they break their leg, they go to the hospital, it's no problem, you know, it's like...
Where in Germany were you?
Huh?
Where in Germany were you?
The person that I lived with was called Joachim Lachenbach in Clayfeld. It's called Clayfeld. That's a little town.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and then, so we lived there for 3 weeks and then Berlin for a week. Just in, like, a hostel the last week. But, it was awesome. And all the German girls were, like, really into us guys from Jersey, you know? Like, we were getting no action in Jersey, you know? We had fucking back acne and braces, and we were all fucked up looking. We go over to Germany, and the girls are like, oh, my God, you're from America. That's so exotic. You know, me and my girlfriends are going over here today. Would you like to accompany us? And we're like,
that's amazing.
I speak some German, but it's not perfect.
What is, you know?
Yeah, hey, I actually went to Oktoberfest a year ago, and I tried to order in German everywhere I went, and then we're just like, okay, so you want the chicken? Like, they were so annoyed with me practicing my German. Like, I'd be like, hey, Bockisch Hähnchen mit Reisbitte, and they'd be like, okay, I'll give you the chicken. Like, they just said it like that. They were so annoyed with me. Because I can't conjugate right or whatever. Should we talk about our friend Heather?
Sure. What is this about? What is this about her?
So, you know, when we did improv back in the day, we had this tall, blonde friend who we met at Jackie Clark's 101 called Heather, you know, codename. And she was a Scientologist, you know? And I was...
Hold on. She was then?
Oh, yes. She was raised in Clearwater, Florida.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. In 2004... Scientologists were all over New York City, offering stress tests.
Yeah.
And I went to one of their events, and it was very strange. If that's surprising, I don't know if that's surprising.
Yeah, go on.
But I went in. Yeah, it was crazy.
You took a personality test? What happened?
Oh yeah, I did. All it is, the e-reader that they have was created in like the 1940s. By a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. He would patent it as a party device. It's like a party game that L. Ron Hubbard got a hold of. Oh, by the way, oh yeah, whatever, we'll get into that in a moment. L. Ron Hubbard got a hold of it and then used it as this e-meter that was, or e-reader, or whatever, that's supposed to recognize stress in your body. It's just essentially just a metal can that you hold. And then it's like measuring electrical activity in the body.
Yeah, it's like, you got salt water, you got neurons, you know, it's like depending on how your blood is flowing through your veins, the needle moves.
So I went to this event, there's always like a street fair that just travels from street to street over the course of the summer every year in New York City. So I met them at one of these things. I went back to their... I think it was the Celebrity Center in Times Square is where I went. And I went to this event, but it was weird because it wasn't really an introduction to new people. It was, there were all these people talking about trying to get their families off of psych drugs. And then it was, they just showed us this award ceremony in Clearwater, Florida. And like everything is gold. And they're talking about like people getting Dianetics in every, you know, the book for Scientology, they're getting that in all of the prisons in Peru. Like, it was really, it was actually really creepy and scary, the way that they were talking about spreading the religion.
Yeah, yeah. There's something ominous to it, because everyone's kind of, you know, anyway, so me and Heather kind of had this fight after, remember the South Park came out? And it was like, this is what Scientologists actually believe. It was flashing that in the bottom of the screen, and it was all about Lord Xenu, you know, took all these aliens and blew them up with hydrogen bombs and volcanoes, and then their bodies perforated the world, and then when you have these body thetan toxins in your body, you know, then that's the goal of Scientology, is to exorcise these thetan demons out of your body. And so I get a phone call from Heather the second that show's over, and she goes, that's not true. We don't worship aliens. And I go, what OT level are you? Because you go clear, then you're OT1, you're OT2, you're OT3. I go, at OT3, you're going to learn that stuff. And I go, what OT level are you? And she's like, I haven't gone clear yet. I'm like, okay, well, at fucking OT level 3, you'll definitely learn that Lord Xenu shit. I go, what level is your mom? I go, what level is your mom? She goes, 7. I go, she knows that. She goes, no, she doesn't. Yes, she does. But if she tells you it, see, they teach you that if you learn esoteric secrets from an OT level above you, that you'll get pneumonia and die. That's what L. Ron Hubbard wrote in, you know, 1960-fucking-1. And so that's it. And when the South Park came out, a lot of Scientologists left because they thought that would Holocaust people. by hearing that information, and then anyone who heard that information would get pneumonia and die. And if you put that
and
in
it
a
proved to be true, all those people died of pneumonia.
That's true. So I also learned that she got a device for her internet that was sold to her by the Church of Scientology that would block her search engines from hearing anything about, like, if you type in Scientology to a search engine, it just goes to Scientology.org, zero other sites available. So she was blocking herself from
knowledge,
which I was just, like, so frustrated with, and eventually we stopped being friends, because I was like, if I can't ask you, like, you know, I was raised Catholic, you know? If you want to know anything about Catholicism or my experience, I'm an open book. I'll say, yeah, I was a Catholic, and then around freshman year, I heard about the pedophile scandal, and I was like, fuck this shit. But, you know, the thing about, say what you want about Catholics, but they have, like, one book, it's the Bible, and that's it. And then it's not, like, a level structure to, like, more esoteric information that you have to pay all this money for, you know? So we were having
esoteric information in the Catholic Church, let's not pretend. But you're right, you're not paying, it's not like a pay-as-you-go, a pay-to-play organization like Scientology.
Or like the Masons, where every level past your level, you know, you enter this contract, but you don't know what's on the other side of the door.
So, yeah, or like improv classes.
Yeah, it's all very hidden.
You know that Del Close claimed he came up with the idea for Scientology, right?
Well, he claimed to be in conversation with L. Ron. They were friends back in the time. I guess they were in a writer's guild together, something like this, right?
I don't know. That's the thing. Look, there's a bunch of, I do know that Del Close studied witchcraft and magical practice. I know that L. Ron Hubbard did as well. But I don't know. I don't know. There's a lot of conflicting reports on whether they actually knew each other very well or not. Because I think Improv Nation, the book Improv Nation, says that Del Close just like showed up at his house one weekend, at L. Ron Hubbard's house. I mean, it sounds like a Del Close thing to do, but it's also highly contested. But I think just the fact that Del Close claims he came up with the idea for Scientology, that L. Ron Hubbard should take his science fiction and turn it into a religion. I mean, it sounds like Del Close.
I mean, yeah, I can't deny that. It's like, hey, if the... Because originally, Dianetics was written to revolutionize psychiatry. So L. Ron goes to, like, the Psychiatrist Board of America and is like, oh, I solved all your problems here. I wrote this book. And they're like, you're an idiot. You don't know anything. You just made it all up. And he's like, fuck you. You don't know I've changed the world. Fuck you. So maybe in this period, he met Del.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is it's crazy. And by the way, this is for people who don't know who Del Close is. He's the guy that's credited with creating modern improv, long form improv.
Yeah.
And he was like, he was definitely in witchcraft and disliking minorities and women. Oh, and he loved Harold.
Yeah, so it is.
Loved it.
Kind of sounds like...
Couldn't get enough.
Aleister Crowley is kind of a character that was around at this time, too. And Aleister Crowley, you know, started the... there was something called the OTO, the Order Temple Aureolis, that Jack Parsons started. And Jack Parsons handed this nine-level structure over to Crowley, who... you know, took it over, and, you know, so then L. Ron was studying the OTO with Crowley, and then who knows if Del Close was in this circle, too, of witches.
To be clear, Parsons is the engineer that created Rocket Fuel, is that correct?
Well, yeah, JPL is Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but also Jack Parsons Laboratory, and this still exists today.
Right. And I forget who else, there's a bunch of guys, I think they were originally in the IOT. Parsons grabbed, I think he took the structure of the IOT and brought it to the OTO. So now we're just talking about esoteric witchcraft.
What's the IOT? I haven't heard of the IOT.
That's still around. I forget what it stands for. I mean, well, good, it's here in my searches. I was looking for it in Oakland, California. What is it? I can't remember what it's called. But yeah, a bunch of those guys were like having sex with demons and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
At the same time.
You know, and then Epstein's Island has a big temple on it, and, you know, it's like, that's interesting.
Wait, what was that?
Jeffrey Epstein, the island, had a temple on it.
Oh, sure.
You know about that?
Oh, it's like the Illuminates of Thanateros. I think they were involved. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is just the OTO. I might be mistaking them. IOT is what Chaos Magic came. Oh, yeah, IOT is from 1978. That's where Chaos Magic came from. Okay. I think you're absolutely right. It was the OTO that they were doing things under.
Yeah. And it's where I know right now the guy who runs the OTO is a person called Lon Diquette. L-O-N-D-I-Q-U-E-T-T-E. And he runs it out of Costa Mesa, California. And but I have very good information that he would always go to the Dallas Scottish Rite building of the Freemasons and do magic for them and then go back to Costa Mesa. So who knows what goes on in those basements.
Right.
I do wonder, like, in the Freemasonic Hall or in the OTO, do they summon black entities? Like dark energies? Do they make smoke monsters and then they're like, okay, well, I'll see you guys next Thursday. Is that what happens?
I mean, I think that's part of it. When Splitsider, again, I'm bringing up Del Close and Improv again, but Splitsider had an article interviewing Jonah Halpern of Improv Olympic, I.O., and she was talking about when she first met Del Close, and he was at a comedy club or something, banishing demons on stage, like summoning and banishing demons as part of his act. And she said that she was there because she wanted to steal his ideas, which I just think is a really funny thing to admit openly. And she got him to agree to teaching classes with her, but he would only do it as long as he could continue to conjure and banish demons during the course of the class. So I'm guessing they're really into that stuff.
You know, and it's like, if they could do that, why don't they put it on Facebook Live? Wouldn't they get more members?
Man. Well, I think we probably learned the invocation opening to the Herald, right? The invocation where you go, like, you get an object from the audience, you're like, oh, it is a spoon, right? You treat it like an object, then you treat it like a person, then you elevate it to godhood, and then you steal its power. That is taken. Del Close came up with that opening, except actually he just took it directly from witchcraft, because it was all about conjuring gods, you know, summoning gods or conjuring demons or any of that stuff. But that's like a common improv practice.
Is that what you're doing? Are you getting closer to God by being able to be gender fluid and bisexual? It's just the world is open to you now. You can do anything.
Hey, that's. I mean. Look, I feel like there's divinity in the unknown, right? The things that we can't control, the chaos around us, I feel like if you treat all of that like an opportunity, it will guide you toward the things that you want in life. And whether you want to see that as a religious practice or as a psychological practice, it doesn't really matter, but it works. So, if you actually kind of make friends with chaos instead of opposing it, it also leads to better comedy.
Are you, is improv your religion? Is comedy your religion?
No, because I don't really like religions, personally. I like belief, and I like faith, and personal rituals and things like that. I think what people don't, I think some of this magical practice stuff is really interesting, but I think it's also good to keep it in mind as a psychological practice. I mean, any god is really just what you're envisioning or the best version of yourself or you know, the best parts of yourself. And I think that a lot of what magical practice actually is psychological practice. It's not like conjuring. It's not like actually flying around or getting a dragon or anything like that. It's really just like... discipline and ritual and doing these sort of metaphorical things to get your brain to work in a different way and have a different experience or have different skills that were already there. It's really a lot of, like, everything I care about, everything I'm interested in is about unlocking myself or unlocking other people, things that are already there, and not and allowing people to get full use of themselves.
Mm. That's
it's
why,
like, you know, yeah sorry.
I just have such an axe to grind with Scientology, because I feel as though it parades itself on being a practice to unlock your full potential, but it is unearthly abusive. In 1982, Rhonda Wolfe, which is L. Ron's brother, did right. this Senate hearing, and I just want to just play a little clip here.
Attempt to make this as painless as possible for you, sir. I know that you were also a courageous individual to be here with us this afternoon, especially because of your background. I would like to ask you a few, before we do ask your question, sir, I'd like to ask you if you would be sworn in by our clerk, please.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it. It's an hour-long clip. I should have fucking cued it better.
All right.
But he goes into, like, they fucking, when Sea Org members would escape, that he would get him in a van, beat the shit out of them, throw him back in the van, bring him back to the fucking Scientology base, like, people who tried to leave, you know? And L. Ron died in 1986, and these testimonies were in 1982, and in 2000 or 98, they got their tax-exempt status with all this abuse on the record. So it's like, to me, it's like, what kind of a world do we live in where, you know, the United States gives them tax-exempt status, which they would have folded if they didn't get it that same year. With all this abuse on the record. But then it's like the U.S. government has darker skeletons in their closet, so who are they to catch judgment, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
I think improv is a little bit better way to get at your best self than Scientology.
I don't know. Yeah, I feel like Scientology is adding... it's like when people try to convert a computer to be both Mac operating system and to be Windows. It's like you're just adding something there that doesn't belong there, and it's going to make the thing work incorrectly. Whereas, yeah, other things like Buddhism or I don't know, transcendental meditation, I've heard they're very much about just opening yourself up and unlocking what's already there instead of, yeah, forcing you to be something that you weren't before.
Hmm.
Like, really what I'm trying to get people to do in the work that I do is reclaim aspects of childhood that they put on the shelf when they decided they weren't going to be a child anymore. And, you know, and like, there's so much to childhood of play and imagination, creativity, and the idea, and then the knowledge that there is much you don't know. You know, children learn so much faster than adults, and it's because of those things. It's because of because of that creativity and that openness to not knowing. That make children learn so much faster, I feel like.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes me think I would always go play paintball. When I lived in Los Angeles, I would go up to Santa Clara, California. And I started getting good, but I would always go on the beginner course. Because the beginners, they go, how do you play paintball? And they go, when you get shot, you walk over here, and you know, you're dead, and you walk over here. And then when I started getting better, I played on the pro course. Everyone was cheating. They got you shoot them, and they wipe the paint off, and they keep playing. And it's like,
right.
The beginners are the ones who are like, how do you play? Oh, that's how you play? Okay, I'll play that way. Pros are just cheating. It's like Wall Street, you know? You get to a certain level of economics, and then you're like, okay, I see how I'm going to pull the dial to fuck over the common man, you know?
Oh, totally. I mean, that's the thing. That's how a lot of things work, where, yeah, it's just the common person doesn't know. It's all about, being esoteric and maintaining a level of knowledge. I was at an improv theater at one point that, and this is not UCB, but I was at an improv theater where it was clear that the new people to the theater had no idea how to make anything at the theater, and the people that had been involved for a long time were just keeping that information themselves and maintaining that. You're definitely always going to have that, but an organization like Scientology really is abusive. and it's too bad, because this person that we're talking about is a really lovely person, and I really only want happiness for her. If she's happy, great, but this concerns me more than anything.
Yeah, and that's, it was just like, I would talk to her in this way of like, okay, so at OT level 3 you learn this, and, you know, why do you think they keep the information locked? And they're like, well, and she would be like, you're not ready for it. And it's like, well, maybe it's all bullshit, like, you know? And then I would be just talking to her like a friend like this, and her eyes would, like, dart around, like, click, 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 click. And I'm like, oh, shit, like, that's her programming, you know? Like, someone, like, hypnotized her where everything I'm saying, I'm the devil now. She screamed at me in a pizza place, are you trying to get me off my religion? I was like, I thought we were talking as friends. And she, like, ran out. You know what I mean? And,
Sure.
You know?
But you were kind of picked, weren't you, though? Let's be honest.
You wanted to have the conversation. I just watched, like, fucking 15 documentaries of people, you know, being tortured by these people and giving their witness testimony of what happened. And I was like, well, this could happen too, or this could happen too. But now she lives on L. Ron Hubbard Way, you know, in Los Angeles, and she's just sucked in by the organization. It makes me real sad.
I don't know. Look, if she's happy, great. But I mean, I don't know. Like I said, worried. That's it.
Yeah, for me, it's just like, I feel as though because I didn't put a block on my internet and I'm able to watch Leah Remini's TV show, it's like, I literally have more information than she does. So that's what concerns me. It's like I have this information that she doesn't. I don't know. But I feel the same way about a lot of these mystical orders, you know. I think that you should communicate to the divine directly.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah. Yes. You should talk directly. Yeah. Because it's just you.
I know, right? Ugh. All right, bud. Well, thanks for doing my podcast, Chris Greer. Well, it was great talking to you today. I'm sorry yesterday I fucked up with the scheduling. Do you want to plug your teaching of improv and where people can find you?
Sure. So, I'm teaching classes in San Francisco right now, but I also travel. Everything I do is through my website, thunderboltcomedy.com. I'm teaching right now. I'm teaching an improvised documentary class where we, improvise a documentary on stage. And I'm looking forward to the graduation show for that class. But I'm also going to be teaching some other, like, improv duo classes, and my Improv 420 workshop will be coming back soon. So all of that will be available on thunderboltcomedy.com.
Thunderboltcomedy.com. Thanks a lot, bud. Good to talk to you, Chris Griswold.
Good talking. Have a good day.
All right, take care. That's been another episode of Highway Diary in the Bag. Thanks to my guest, Chris Griswold. Check out thunderboltcomedy.com. Later.